The day Maurice Gleitzman came to visit, to sit down and be a guest on Read This, happened to be during the school holidays. More than one member of staff here had a patient child stuck in the office while mum or dad worked. So when word got out that Maurice was here, a palpable frisson went through the building. There was a bona fide celebrity in our midst.
My name is Tess. I'm 10 years old, and my favourite Maurice Gleitzman book is Now. I think that Maurice Gleitzman books are really diverse. Some of them are adventure, some of them are humour, some of them are just strange.
I'm Anya. During the summer, our uncle read us 2 Weeks with the Queen. It's about a kid whose brother gets cancer. It was great.
You can go back to pretty much any Australian childhood since the late 80s, and if the kid in question was a reader, Maurice Gleitzman was on their bookshelves. His titles read like a litany of kid-friendly nonsense. Misery Guts, Worry Warts, Blabbermouth, Sticky Beak, Belly Flop. But he's most known by parents, teachers and kids for his light touch when it comes to tackling big ideas, from seeking asylum to experiencing cancer in your family to the Holocaust. Maurice Gleitzman doesn't treat his readers like children, and his readers love him for it.
I'm Hector Bennett-Williams, and this is Read This, my dad's show about the books we love and the stories behind them.
Not wanting to be outdone by the enthusiastic fandom of children, I began my chat with Maurice by telling him about my early memory of seeing him give a talk in the late 80s at a Children's Book Council event at Dallas Brooks Hall. It was about his classic book, 2 Weeks with the Queen, and as best as I can recall, I must have been about 8 or 9 at the time. 2,000 kids and an author being feted like an absolute rock star. That was my memory. So I asked him whether the performance aspect of the job came easily.
Before I started writing books, I had a decade or so writing comedy for television, but also for live performance. And I was lucky enough to work with some really good performers. And I often stood in the wings, partly checking that they were not missing any of my funny adverbs, but also just noting how they did it. And I think enough of that rubbed off that when I found myself on a stage, which is not the first thing you think about when you contemplate the life of a writer. Something else, as an aside, I must say that I'm also getting used to is sitting opposite somebody whose every demeanour makes me feel that he's a sort of father figure for most of the people in his professional life. And here he is saying that, oh, I think I met you when I was 8 in 1988. And I'm thinking, well, yes, you probably did. But, oh, that's a paradigm shift for our conversation today.
I'm very sorry, Maurice. It's funny, I did consider not saying it. I thought my upbringing, I was like, is it rude to say, I remember loving your writing when I was a child, or not? But
not at all. I prefer to take the survivor mode rather than the decrepit old geezer mode. So mentally, yeah.
I think, I mean, the main reason I wanted to dwell on it was that extraordinary thing about generational contribution. I mean, at this point, you have been writing for me, for my children now, you know, that the pleasure has been handed on from one generation to the next. And there is something about that that seems like an extraordinary and singular contribution to me.
Well, it's both sobering and thrilling. I can remember when at the signing table quite a few years ago now, I first started to see lovingly tattered copies of some of my early books, and each child would excitedly tell me that their mum or their dad had this actual copy when they were in primary school and it's been passed on. And since I am starting to do the maths, I guess it can't be too far off the next generation.
Yeah.
As well, which, okay, let's...
Yeah, no, let's move on from that. That's too distressing. Look, I was a late bloomer, so that'll be a gift to you there. That's
I was a very early starter as a writer, obviously.
There you go, I know. Child writer. So child writer, Maurice Gleitzman. Across your work, one of the things that has made you connect with readers of all ages for so long now is your capacity to take serious or sober topics and your capacity to take joyous, ludicrous, fun and silliness and have the two go hand in hand in the way that all children understand that they must. Is that central to your mission statement for yourself?
Yes, I think it's a product of, from the earliest books of mine, having a strong sense that stories, particularly for young people, stories have a capacity to deal in possibilities. And what I think young readers deserve is that they not be only the best possibilities, because I think we all and kids today still become aware that our lives are participating in a dance between the worst possibilities and the best possibilities and everything that lies between. I know that there have been teen genres that prefer to focus just on the worst possibilities. And I think it's selling a story short to choose one or the other, because out of that dance, out of that tension that we're all so familiar with, even if we don't think about it specifically from a young age, comes the power of a story and its significances and its usefulnesses as well. Because I think when you're a young reader, you want to be transported emotionally, intellectually, experientially, just as we do as older readers. But at a time of life where almost every moment of every day, every blink, every turn of the head is bringing new stuff in.
I know that a series of books that were important to you as a young reader that you returned to, I believe, as an adult, are the Just William books. And they seem to me to be a wonderful archetypal example of how important mischief is in a young life, how important ratbags and troublemakers might be. Are you temperamentally drawn to ratbags, to the Williams of the world?
I am in a slightly ambivalent way, because I'm a control freak. So I'm attracted to it, but kind of a bit horrified and terrified of it too. But I love those books because I love the transgressiveness of them. But I also had a sense that there was a gap between the adult perceptions of what William and his gang of young roughnecks, the outlaws, were actually up to and why. And they probably saw it as much more mischievous than those characters saw it, and as I saw it as a young reader. Because I guess I wouldn't have used these words back then when I was 8, 9, 10, but I think I was fascinated by this version of creative problem solving and how the more creative one is in one's problem-solving approach, the bigger the chance that things aren't actually going to work out, first time at least, and that there may be sort of mayhem and destruction resulting. But I never saw William Brown as an anarchist or as a terrorist. I saw him as a very creative and optimistic thinker when it came to doing things that he thought were necessary or worthwhile. And sometimes they were, you know, largely self-serving, but other times they weren't. And he was kind of looking out for others in a way that the adults in his world never fully understood, I think. And that's understandable too, because when you're a parent and you see the mess, the physical mess, before you see the good intentions often.
It is a big part, I think, of reading when you're a kid, is that idea that your intentions or your imaginative world or whatever are misunderstood by the adults in your life. That slippage between the two, between the world that you're living in and the grown-up world, is where the drama exists in great children's literature. And it's a classic Maurice Gleitzman feature, I think, in your work, is that space between the child's understanding of what their objectives are, what their reality is, and the grown-ups around them.
I've always been sympathetic, even before I was fully started to experience it myself, that the the logistics and the untidiness often of family life is quite exhausting, particularly if you're a bit of a control freak. And so I would see in, say, those William books, and I'd even catch some of my adult characters behaving in a way that they weren't being their best selves at that moment, but they were doing their best at that moment. And I've tried to make that distinction. And I've also, because I think another tension that's run through my stories, whether they are about tough and serious areas of life where characters displaying the worst that our species is capable of are alongside characters displaying the best, that's perhaps easier to see in a story set against the Holocaust, for example. Whereas some of my earlier and more obviously humorous books, where there's a greater degree of comic exaggeration, I've always looked for the biggest problem in a character's life at the point that the story starts. And I've always hoped that they will be big problems. They may not involve, you know, the fall of civilizations, but inside that child, I want there to be nothing more important to them at that time. And so often busy adults, or just adults who've become a bit too adult, make a mistake that they've either adopted as a permanent view, or for busy parents can just be a momentary thing where children are physically smaller. And it's easy to just assume sometimes that what's going on inside them is commensurately smaller. And of course it's not. And sometimes my young characters will just be pulled up short for a moment when they realize that an adult in their life is not aware of how big a deal this is, mm-hmm. and how big are the feelings about it. And although I always tell my stories, even in a third person book, through the eyes and thoughts and feelings of the central young character or characters, I try to find ways, without actually going fully to an adult's point of view, I try to find ways of letting us inside those adults a little bit too.
When we return, Morris Gleitzman talks about his latest book, Tweet, and reveals why, when you're a self-confessed control freak, a little bit of chaos can be important. We'll be right back.
As a 7am listener, you value the story behind the headlines. That's why you should read Post, a free daily newsletter bringing you the top 5 news stories of the day, summarising each of their key points with links to full articles from a range of sources. Get the news you need to your inbox every weekday morning with Post. Sign up at thesaturdaypaper.com.au/newsletters.
There's nowhere like The Monthly. Long-form journalism that doesn't just respond to the news cycle, it shapes it. Subscribe today from just $7.25 at themonthly.com.au/subscribe. The Monthly, Australia's only news magazine.
Morris Gleitzman's new book is called Tweet, and this is what the blurb says. Birds, lots of birds. The people of the world are puzzled. Their feathered friends are trying to tell them something, and they're not sure what it is. Then a boy and his pet budgie discover the secret. Join Jay and Clyde and their friends Maxine and Dora on an exciting, funny, risky journey to save their families, and every other family too.
That's 10-year-old Lottie giving us a rundown of what to expect in Morris Gleitzman's latest book, Tweet. It's his 45th novel. Yes, you heard that correctly. 45 novels. And as ever, Morris is tackling yet another big topic with his trademark humour and warmth. This time, it's climate change. And the idea for this book seems to have been brewing for a while.
If I remember this correctly, when you were writing 2 Weeks with the Queen, initially you were writing a book about a girl who befriended and then had to defend a group of fruit bats. And your new book, Tweet, has some echoes in there of that long ago idea. Is there a through line, or is that just a coincidence?
you have so dazzled me with the depth of your research or the absolute indefatigability of your memory that I have to say maybe. Certainly, the starting point for me, which was like many writers for young people, I'd lived in a particular context for 10 or 15 years, which is how can we usefully write in any way about what's happening to the planet and climate, etc., for kids in a way that, I mean, my personal mantra has always been, no matter what I'm going to write about, I give my absolute everything to try not to write a story in which the young main character or characters feel worse about themselves and their place in the world at the end of the story compared to how they did at the beginning. If perchance I'd done that, that book would never be published. So this gives rise to a lot of thought when you're writing about things like the Holocaust, say, or terminal illness in a child, or what we're very much hoping is not yet terminal illness in a planet. And I wasn't sure how to do it, so I didn't. I know other writers for young people feel the same. But without any particular agenda, I just found myself imagining a large group of birds, thousands of them, standing calmly and resolutely on a major arterial road at the edge of a city, blocking the traffic, and being prepared to not move even when some of the more extreme human reactions caused their death or the death of some of them. And then I started to think, because at first I thought, well, interesting short story. But then I thought this could actually be an invitation to sort of tap into the expanding worldviews and interests and understanding of young people and say, here's a problem that's worth thinking about. Maybe a really good starting point for how this is going to play out, however it will or could, is to say, are we still a group of individuals capable of accepting that we're perhaps not quite as special and quite as uniquely different because of our specialness from every other living thing on the planet? So I realized that this could be the story that I've been looking for a long time. But I also knew that I wanted to have a couple of young characters who would be going on we used to call them sort of rites of passage things. I wanted a big physical and emotional journey for two young characters. And it turned out that one is a boy and one's a budgie.
I was going to say the challenge of your budgie character and Clyde, I mean, it does echo a recurring Maurice Gleitzman concern, which is about the nature of communication and how we communicate to one another and not be at cross purposes. Going back to, is it Rowena in Blabbermouth and Sticky Beak?
Yes.
A character who quite literally doesn't have a voice. And in this most recent one, Tweet, trying to find the voice of a bird and trying to write in the voice of a bird. Mm. What a fun challenge.
Well, yes. I spent some time thinking how certain other writers would be far more capable than I am of creating at least the illusion of a language so different from our own. And I didn't feel able to do that. And I also, and this was perhaps rationalization, wasn't 100% certain that that would be the best way to tell this particular story. Glorious literary achievement, though it would have been. So I made the bird character a bird who identifies as much as a human as he does as a bird. But then, because of his love for his best friend at the beginning of the story, who is a human, they go on a journey together for a while and then separate for a while and then ultimately together again. And for Clyde the budgie, he starts interacting with wild birds. And he starts out with a deep disapproval of these savages who eat each other or who eat other members of their own species, some of them. But of course, he discovers that although he was born in a pet shop and has lived in the bosom of a loving human family, he's still a bird, and a whole range of possibilities for him open up.
one of the things that I so admire about your work is that adroit thinking about form and technique isn't visible on the page. On the page is play and joy and character and plot. And so for all you describe yourself as a control freak, and it must take tremendous control to manage that, you do have a gift for then, maybe it's just an even further level of control, but it does disappear. It does recede. The play is ultimately the thing.
Two or three of the people I've been close to at different times in my life who have noted often how I can be having a conversation with them, but without consciously realizing it, I am at the same time just adjusting a pile of magazines on the coffee table, so that have observed that one of the reasons that I perhaps do the work I do and love it is that I get to experiment with the boundaries of all that. And in fact, because I learned very early on that the relationship between the writer and the characters, which necessarily for me is a relationship between an adult and kids, that the whole thing would be stifled at birth if I try to be a control freak in terms of those kids. So there's a lot of delicate balances, but I've learned that in at least one area of my life not to try and control everything. But it's a delicate balance because I do have a responsibility. These kids come to me, they come into my imagination, and they have huge problems. And I feel that my capacity to be quite a good organizer is a resource that's available to them. But at the same time, it works best if there's a balance. So I plan my books, and I do maybe 8 or 10 drafts of an outline, just a short document, maybe 4 or 5 pages. But it's where I see the key physical and emotional and conceptual movements of those characters, their outer and their inner worlds. It's the journey. But it's very useful because there's a very, very precious currency at stake in writing books for kids, and that is time and attention. Because there's just so many alternatives, and not just the obvious ones like, screen culture and all the rest of it. It is just, you know, every time a young reader looks up from a book and something catches their eye, that's very likely to be a new experience. So you just have to accept that you're not necessarily going to be the most important thing in that young person's day or hour or minute. Something I'm proudest of is that over these decades, I've learned to find a balance. And if that character sees something over on the hill or down an interesting looking side street and they go off, I go with them. And in the early days, I thought, we're leaving the map, we're leaving the plan. This is going to end up being 700 pages of sort of drivel. But I just learned to say, no, if we get lost, we've got the means to find our way back. But chances are we won't get lost. We'll end up somewhere better.
That's an exciting evolution as a writer and a thinker and as a human being.
Hmm.
Where in your life do you most let yourself be chaotic?
What a good question. Choose my words carefully here because I try to be open to what might at first feel like chaotic thinking when I'm open to the possibilities of a story or even, you know, what type of story the next story might be. I've never been asked this before, and it's making me realize that there is kind of objective chaos, but what's more relevant to me is what feels chaotic. And sometimes it's good. It's great to feel, oh, this is a bit chaotic.
Yeah, the heart racing from lack of control is not a bad feeling.
No, because, look, I can be an amateur psychologist and say that, of course, a compulsion to try and control things is based on fear and anxiety. And part of that fear and anxiety is that if you let go of the control, I'll be swept away on a tidal wave of uncontrollability to ruin, destruction and oblivion. So to have a few experiences where you think, well, this is out of control. In fact, the state emergency service should probably be called any moment now. But they're not, and you get through and you've survived. Very important.
Yeah.
Life lesson.
Would you would you go back and edit or censor a previous work that you'd written because the context, the social mores had changed? As a control freak, surely one of the hard things for you must be accepting a book is done and not getting back under the hood.
Yes, I don't think you have to be a control freak for that to be a quandary as a writer, because it's the end to your work with those characters is always a slightly artificial construct. You know, it's a practical one because the book has to be printed and published. That is an incredibly important question, and I think it is increasingly on the minds of a lot of fiction writers who've been lucky enough to have a long writing career and a body of work that is still to some degree alive in print or available. And I don't really know the answer to it, because part of me thinks that it is a shame, a big shame, to deprive readers, including young readers, of a sense that stories on the page aren't as fixed and immutable as they might appear at first glance, because they come alive in slightly different ways in the minds of every different reader. I think it's good for kids to see how our world changes in all sorts of ways, including that there are attitudes that were not interrogated 20, 30, 50 years ago that are now. When a story is written, whatever the reasons are it's written, and whatever the hopes are for the author as to what will happen in the minds and the imaginations of readers, probably it being an artifact of the changes over time of social attitudes and priorities and preferences was probably not on the agenda. And if it becomes a very useful and important artifact to remind us of that and to illustrate it, does it detract from what the writer initially hoped it would achieve? How important is that? Is it reasonable for a writer to want a story to be the same sort of thing in the minds of readers after 10 or 20 or 30 or 50 years? So the many, many big questions here.
Well, I can't wait to sit down and chat to you when my grandchildren are massive fans of your work and we can just double down again and keep doing that. Morris Gleitzman's latest book, Tweet, is out now, as are his other 44 books, still in print, still there for the kid in your life to fall in love with.
From the Saturday paper comes The Food, a free weekly newsletter featuring curated recipes from some of the country's leading chefs, including Andrew McConnell, Otama Carey, David Moyle, and Karen Martini. Cook what they cook by subscribing today at thesaturdaypaper.com.au/newsletters.
Before we go, on the topic of what I've been reading this week, the truth of it is I've been reading The Monthly. You may be aware, in my day job, I edit that almost 20-year-old magazine, Australia's only magazine of news, current affairs, and culture. And we're keen to make sure that as a Read This listener, you get a special chance to subscribe at a discount rate. Go to themonthly.com/subscribe and enter promo code READTHIS, all one word, and you can get a digital or print subscription at 30% off. That's themonthly.com/subscribe and enter the promo code READTHIS. That's it for this week's show.
Please like and subscribe and share with your friends.
There's no new Read This next week because of the public holiday, but when we come back in 2 weeks, I'm chatting with the brilliant Sloane Crosley about her new book, Grief Is For People, and her move from comic writing to memoir.
I consider memoir in some ways, even though this is a book about life and death and very serious subjects, it seems grander. It seems like a grand, like, I'm going to start from the beginning and tell my story, but I suppose that's autobiography. I don't know. I think we're all mixed up about it. None of us are French, and it was sort of like the de facto word to describe this thing.
Read This is produced and edited by Clara Ames. Mixing and original compositions by Zoltan Fecho. And a big thank you to Tess, Lottie, Anya and Hector for their contributions to this week's show. Thanks for listening. See you in a couple of weeks' time.
Pop the button.
Stop saying I popped the button. I'm mainly getting away with it. I'm passing. You're both mean. You're mean
Tell
girls.
Tell everyone that he popped a
okay,
button.
Okay, that's enough now. Shut it down. Clara, we're not using any of this.
Yes, we are.